Coming up, it's Media Matters with Marie Buskey and Marty Gibson, discussing the media through the RCR lens.
Right here on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio. And it's so good to bring back into the counterculture fold, be back into a morning. My partner in crime, Marty Gibson, getting ready for a long weekend. Marty, what have you and the chickens got planned?
Well, yeah, a lot of what I've been doing over the weekend and in my spare time is chicken related. You're right. I've fenced them in along the north and west boundaries of my section. Now I'm in the process of fencing other sections within that to grow berries and also to grow chicken greens that they can peck at. So, yep, I've got all my spring gardens. It gives me a feeling of being the World Economic Forum, actually, but less evil. The problems with free speech, there's lots of clucking in the morning. Although I was relieved to hear it's not disturbing the family over the back. I've got a newborn baby. They say it's actually quite good. We just say to our kids, hey, what are the chickens up to? And they all go and get out of the house and have a look. I'm wondering if the upcoming fluoridation of Tauranga's water supply through, you know, the government bullying, threatening of the mayor and councillors will shave a few IQ points off and help prevent escapes. A couple of pesky tinfoil hat-wearing chickens who are trying to tell the others that far from being the big dominant cock of their dreams, I'm cynically farming them for their eggs.
Hey, what's the vibe amongst the hood? Because I know you chat to your neighbours a lot. What's the vibe about them on this fluoridation thing?
I think a lot of people don't want it. You know, as I said last week, I think a lot of people's willingness to do things because the public health officials say so, including mass medication, are zero. I think people's acceptance of ad hominem attacks as a counter-argument to concerns that people raise, which are very valid, people's tolerance to put up with that is zero. Zero among a good portion of some people obviously love being told what to do, and those people are a problem.
I see, too, one of the themes that I've seen across many things in the media this last week has been like that old ad, you know, togs, 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 undies, undies, undies. And we've been living in a world of togs, 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 and we're at the beginning, we're at the first undies now. We've crossed the road, we're at the first undies. And I think you brought up a good point with that fluoridation issue. I think more people now are less trusting of being told what to do and just blindly accepting it and realising that this is mass medication of a population without permission, even the governing body to which you elect for your local community has said no, and they are being bullied by Big Brother of the state and the government. And it's not on, actually, and it's nice to see people are thinking, you know what, this isn't on.
I think people are starting to realise the extent to which the techniques that are being used on them have been carefully formulated out of pretty intimate study of human psyches. It's been designed to exploit the worst characteristics of humans, our tendency to form into tribes, our desire to stay in the group. I guess you gave a speech on Saturday to a Good Oil group here in Tauranga, lovely people. Many of them regularly listen to the show and RCR generally. And one of the things I talked about there was if you've got a village, you only need so many notices in the village. You only need so many people who are anticipating problems because you don't want everyone to stop digging and do that. And a big part of what's been foisted on humanity is that the fat controllers and the people who print the money have characterized those notices as a threat to the people who normally just want to get on with digging.
Yeah.
We've got to reclaim our rightful position as people who raise valid concerns and expect valid answers.
Well, even Ashley Bloomfield, I know we're heading a little bit off topic, but even the article with Ashley Bloomfield saying that these health emergencies actually need to be considered security threats now. I mean, Paul did a fantastic interview, it was a couple of days ago, on Breakfast, Monday Breakfast with it. And it's just like, oh, for goodness sake, people, we need to get back to that place of, as you said, the fat controllers are up there putting the notices out. But I think we've forgotten the strength and the power of our own self-agency. that's where that undies moment is coming in, because when you've been wanting to conform, you've been terrified of being in the art group, you know, those crazy tinfoil.
You've been trying to sleep, but the alarm's going off and you're trying to ignore it and hold on to your sleep, but your consciousness is coming.
Yeah, exactly. And you've been out in the back paddock and those, you know, as a group have started to coalesce, more and more people are starting to sort of wake up to the realities of what has been going on.
And the reality is that those who, as Plato said, I think, those who consider themselves aloof from politics are destined to be ruled by their inferiors. And here we are.
Mm. Mm. So let's sort of start with the economy, because Nicola Willis, I have to admit, I had kind of visions of Nicola Willis quietly, you know, in her office at Parliament, sort of doing a Donald Trump type little silent dance to herself and a few little gesticulations in her own private space at the joy that the inflation rate was down to 2.2% after everybody on the other side of the fence told her that tax cuts were going to be inflationary. So she must have had surely a little private moment of yes. So for her, you know, that is a great win. However, that's really only the tip of the iceberg. I think the fact that that rate of inflation is into the between 1% and 3% band, great, that's good news. But the flow-on effect, I think, is we're only at that cusp of the wavefront now, the flow-on effect of all financial mismanagement for the previous 6 years is still going to be felt. And I think, aren't they talking about employment looking to surge is beyond, well beyond 5%, I think even 5.4 by 2026-27. And we're seeing that Smithfield plant in Timaru, the Kiwi Rail now looking at hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs lost. Voluntary redundancies now, Health New Zealand, 400 have been accepted already with more to come. We are just at the tip of that iceberg of people, all of a sudden, the jobs, if you are somebody who's eager and willing to work, a job may not always be there, and even more so if you're in the public service being paid, what did they say, an average of well over six figures. If you do get a job, it may not be as valuable as the one you may have had.
Well, and yeah, people tend to live right up to their capacity to spend money as well. So there are plenty of people who are going to be in real trouble, and the flow-on effects will continue. Heather Du Plessis-Allen wrote a great article excoriating the Reserve Bank, and I think that urge by the establishment to protect their own and not just lay it right out about what a disaster Adrian Orr's been, what a disaster Cuddles Costa was. You know, they just should have shuffled them into some other job, because if they start being honest about it, then they might face a revolt by public service and by association from the media. She points out that the lingering effects of the overly high OCR rate is going to continue to wash through the economy for a year, even if they cut it by 75 basis points, which is great news for me, because I'm having to pay a shed load of interest at the moment. Yeah, it's nice to hear her. You know, if you accept that the Reserve Bank squeezed too hard, then you accept that it hurt more Kiwis than it needed to in order to get the job done. Which, what makes it all of this worse, of course, is that the bank overdid the squeeze only because it first overdid the money pumped into the economy. Stuffing it up in one direction is tragic. Stuffing it up in both directions is incompetent. So it's good to see someone saying that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, Adrian, he's been running around going, look at my really cool board shorts. I'm in my togs. And it's like, dude, we all see you're in your budgie smugglers. Actually, in fact, you're in your jocks. And it ain't pretty. And it's time to realise this. It'll be interesting to see whether they do that 75-point basis. They need to. How many people have to tell you, we know you're stuffed up? What harm is in there to actually go, look, yeah, maybe we did squeeze it a bit tough. Here you go. Let's try and get this opened up again and make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, she points out inflation in New Zealand is right smack in the middle of the target. And our interest rates are considerably higher than Australia.
Yeah. 4.75
considerably stubbornly higher.
Yeah, so 4.75% here, the OCR is still sitting at 4.75. That's higher than Australia's benchmark interest rate, which is 4.35, and their consumer price index is sitting at 3.8. And we're 2.2.
And you always got to do the cui bono, you know. Who does profit from more being charged for money that's worth less? Well, government, who use it as an extra tax, using fatflation as an extra tax.
The other word that cropped up in many articles over the weekend, and it's something that you and I have discussed multiple times here, is the word productivity. And several weeks ago, we did Marty's five-step guide to employing people. So if you didn't check that out on Media Matters, it was about 3 weeks ago, I think we did it. Definitely, if you're an employer, worth listening to that five-step guide in terms of the people out there in employment. And productivity was one of the things. I mean, Liam Dan brought it up. I did comb through waiting to see the monetary theory is working, monetary theory is working. But he expanded out to seven different points, productivity being his number three. I also noted Stephen Joyce brought up productivity in his column. Productivity has been the one sort of elephant in the fiscal room for such a long time. You and I as business owners know how vital productivity is. And it's like, no, we can't worry about productivity. We need to worry about everything else. We've got to worry about DEI. We need to worry about minimum wage. We need to worry about the human input. Human input is great, and I'm all for human input in a business. But if you don't have realistic output of that business, there is no business for the human input to go into. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, we've had an extended period living on a credit card. I mean, we've all, not all, but a lot of us have done that at some point in our life. We've just kind of blinded ourselves to the reality of our consequences of our actions and lived a bit high on the hog on debt. And then you not only run out of credit or decide that it's not tenable, so you've got less to spend that you've borrowed, but you've got to pay what you borrowed back. So it's a double whammy, which makes the wheedling from Labour politicians and the media even more galling, doesn't it? It's like, you did a lot of this. And, you know, as Matthew Hooton often points out, it's not just Labour. It's Labour and it's National since the Key government. They weren't that much better. It was a very short-term thinker. There was a great interview with Rob McCulloch that's listening to. And one of the great things that he said, this was on Paul's breakfast show, is that New Zealand needs to try different things. And I'm seeing a bit of that come out. You know, we've got Matthew Hooton proposing a 12.5% business tax rate. There's a series of suggestions from a doctor on how to reform the health system by Dr. Art Nahil, an Auckland-based specialist general physician, medical educator, and writing with 30 years of experience, educated in Yale. Which, again, that sort of puts up my antenna. You know, it's a skull and bones. It's very much like Harvard is for some things. It's the center of the globalist blob. It's very much a center of that. So I do wonder about it, because a lot of what he says speaks to that impulse that a lot of doctors had towards a socialist authoritarian system. He talks about healthcare reform must be addressed urgently and must cease being fodder for political squabbling. The government must help facilitate the creation of healthy choice environments, read sugar tax. The reach and scope of community-based primary care must be drastically expanded. Sounds like the Democrat wet dream about free healthcare. Higher rate of graduates entering and staying in the primary care workforce. The number of training spots available in New Zealand should be adjusted based on projected workforce needs, planned economy. The effects of private specialist and hospital care on the quality, timeliness and equity of services offered within the public health system must be urgently studied. That's an interesting little one, isn't it?
Oh, isn't that just? Isn't that just?
It sounds like, hey, these doctors getting to do their private stuff is not good for the proletariat.
And they're getting rich. No, comrade, that is not good. It is not good for the people.
How pink a lot of those doctors are. We need, this is another one. This is where the Yale thing kicked in. And I thought, who is this guy? We need a national electronic health record to better care for individual patients and to better capture data on the changing health needs of our communities. It's one of those things that sounds so good, like, how are young people going to prove how old they are to get their free bus rides? Oh, we'll have to give them a digital ID. How are we going to make sure that young people in Australia aren't on social media? Oh, they're going to need a digital ID.
Yeah. I listened to that interview with Paul and Rob, which, I mean, as I've said before, Rob is my favourite irascible professor. I love the fact that he's not afraid to say the views that we will whisper or we will talk about here on this station, and he will put those ideas out into the wider zeitgeist. Yeah. He'll say, hey, you know, he's prepared to be disagreeable. He's prepared to apply contrary view. And he's right. You need to throw
he's
more
right. He's not scared.
No, and he's far from scared.
He's not consulted in interviews by the paper for his views, which offer a valuable contrast to the myriad of bank economists that they traditionally seek out, who all say pretty much the same thing.
And so here we have, like, in that situation with that doctor, right? That is not any new idea. All you're doing is doubling down on the existing, in the health system, the existing bad ideas that have gotten us to the position and the place that we've gotten to already. It is absolutely mind-boggling. And how many times, Martin, do you have to say that, you know, people in this place where governments want to do things that demand more government and less freedom. Mm. And when really we actually need to, as a population, rediscover our own self-agency and realise that if we want to get out of all of the shtum that we're in, part of it is actually us putting on our big boy and girl pants and speaking up and being a little bit disagreeable about the things that we don't like the fluoride in our water, you know, our health system that is crumbling. And you look at ACC, that was the other big thing. We talked about it in political panel, this big hole in ACC. And now there was the article about the fact that they've now had to put aside, $3.4 billion for those who are victims of sexual abuse. The case that was won at Court of Appeal, let me find it.
It was on the front page of the Herald, I think.
Yes, you are correct. $3.6 billion win at the Court of Appeal. And the person that won the case, Sarah, before rape survivor, referred to simply as Sarah, won her legal battle against ACC in December. ACC only compensated those who reported childhood injuries when they were under the age of 18. So essentially they've gone and put aside $3.6 billion for people who have been the victim of this sort of trauma and have this inability to work. Now, instantly I read that and the natural side of you has the compassion of, gosh, that's unbelievably awful, and you really do feel compassionate towards the trauma that they've suffered. But then the big old grumpy lady pants part of me says, who's going to jump on the gravy train of this one? All I can see is this being rife for abuse, to which Sarah does say.
Yeah, there was risk concerns, didn't she, about?
She did, and she said, I would love to have a job and just be a contributing member of society, but despite this, Sarah is worried the court ruling could expose ACC to fraud. I don't know whether I should be saying this, she admitted, but she feared some people would pretend to be victims just to make money. That keeps me awake at night. The short answer to that is, Sarah, yes, they will, and I know that they will because we're seeing it already. Victimisation has been commoditised. You are a commodity if you are a victim. We now have state-sponsored, to the tune of $3.6 billion, if required, fund if you can claim victimhood, and it doesn't necessarily need to be proven. I mean, in her case, horrific. She actually has the paper trail to be able to approve the abuse that she has. However, ACC Chief Executive Megan Main explained, ACC doesn't require claimants to use criminal convictions to prove that they were abused.
Right, so it's already there. As Bill Burr said, you know, there's that whole sort of focus on believe all women. And he's like, yeah, I mean, I get it, maybe 85, 90%, but all of them? What about the ones that cut up your clothes and key your car?
It's that whole sense of self-responsibility again, though. I think we've got to unhitch. We've got to unhitch our pony from the state. And, I mean, ACC is the most unusual of entities internationally. I don't think Kiwis actually get how truly unique ACC is in the canon of socialised care, insurance and medicine. I mean, nothing like this exists anywhere else. And I think we've become a little bit too used to having this soft landing. At the end of the day, shit happens to good people. we've always had, from a medical standpoint, ACC there as a soft landing for us. So then if something does happen, you've got that landing with ACC. Whereas other parts of the world, Australia, Canada, the United States, generally insurance will pick that up.
Yeah, I mean, it was to stop money getting sucked out of the health system and into the courts, wasn't it? Just getting back to that lady, Sarah, I've known a lot of women have suffered terrible abuse and it went unreported. In fact, you know, a good percentage of them, it did. So I'm not trivializing that at all. There probably needs to be a lot more done to take a lot of people who have done that and still walking around out, or at least hold them accountable. Mm. It would be almost worth, in some parts of New Zealand, having a truth and reconciliation committee. What brings a lot of women years and years later to bring charges isn't suddenly discovering it or having a grudge. It's realizing that their abuser probably went on to abuse others and they've got a moral duty to prevent that. So, wow.
Well, the other thing too is the claims there, of course, in Sarah's case, is for wages lost because she wasn't able to work due to trauma. And she said that she'd love to be able to work, but she finds too many situations triggering, whether it be sights, smells, music, or what have you. Well, then if you're going to have to pay that money out, why isn't that money then going into counselling and mental health services directly to help you get over all of those triggers to allow you to re-enter the workforce?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're going to hit that problem that the credit cards hit its limit and we're paying back what we spanked when we were dancing around having a student males association dinner with champagne.
You know, the other thing I said to you before, I mean, I did the big rustle of papers before. There isn't actually that much in the paper this week at all. Like, I had to really do a big zoom out. And the economy was one of the biggest issues that we have just touched on now. But the other thing in the zoom out that I kept looking at was that whole sort of togs, 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 undies, 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 how ideology now is making way for reality.
Mm.
Christopher Luxon is having to deal with this. Nicola Willis has had this nice little win with the inflation. But with the, you know, what's gone on with us now in the last few weeks, and, you know, I spoke about that briefly last week, is one of the things that I've definitely noticed. I saw a small thing in the paper, and it was a very nondescript article in the weekend's paper about a cult conference. So a conference around the formations of cults that happened in Christchurch over the weekend. And in the work that I do in the culture space, one of the things that we often talk about with woke ideology is it has a lot of the sort of characteristics of a cult. And I've also spoken, as you know, a lot about Matthias Desmet and his psychology of totalitarianism and his mass formation psychosis. However, I have been looking at the whole definition of a cult, and that's a group perceived as requiring unwavering devotion to a set of beliefs and practices which are considered deviant and outside the norms of society, usually led by a charismatic leader who tightly controls its numbers. And this is where we're getting now with the togs, togs, togs. In this country for 6 years, many of its citizens were in that cult. And they were in the cult of COVID, the cult of Jacinda Ardern, the cult of Labour, the cult of socialised governance.
The cult of Ashley Bloomfield.
The cult of Ashley Bloomfield.
That little Woody Allen groomer, Michael Baker.
Exactly. And that cult now has started to disband. It's started to dissipate. And that first undies moment is now happening for a lot of people.
And they're not nice undies. They're saggy jockeys that are, you know, far, far beyond their original white colour.
Yeah. And we're seeing it, I think, with this whole fluoridation issue. You know, like, I mean, when people say, oh, no, that can't be a cult because it says he's considered deviant outside the norms of society. Well, just look at COVID. Public health measures of hundreds of years of standing and tested ability were thrown out the window with COVID. Well, surely that's going against that's outside the norms of society. You've got the Bill of Rights. I mean, most countries have their bills of rights or other elements of human rights absolutely cromped all over in the name of an emergency. So that's outside of the norms of society. Horizontal policing, you know, I mean, don't talk to your neighbours. Put a teddy bear in the window. I mean, when is putting a teddy bear in the frickin' window normal?
The other thing is that point I made earlier about the extent to which human frailty has been studied and integrated into the response, particularly around COVID. It was war-gamed. They practiced it. They theorized. And as James Corbett and RFK Jr. discussed, when they were wargaming it, they weren't wargaming, well, how do we treat people and control the outbreak? The wargaming was about how do we get Western governments to pivot to a dictatorship, co-opt social media and media to work with us to achieve our ends. It was quite sinister. And that stuff's all just there. It comes back to my frequent complaint that people who say, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, don't mean they've studied them and found them as a theory wanting. They mean it scares me to think that might be so, because it would destabilize my entire framework that I use to make sense of the world.
Yeah. It's the weaponization of kindness. And that upsets me, because I consider myself a pretty relaxed, easygoing, sort of kind, empathetic person. And I feel like that those sorts of traits in me and in other people close to me were hijacked and weaponized against them. And I mean, I never fell into the cult. I mean, I saw it straight away for what it was, because I'd been in this culture war for several years prior to COVID. So because I'd already been there, I could see it as plain as day as what was going on. What amazed me, level-headed, rational people around me that didn't see it. And the other reason I see this as a cult is, unlike a movement, a political movement, where you sit on one side or another, this cult of COVID captured everybody right across the political spectrum. And people that you thought that would be naturally immune to it were the ones that were in there, even bigger in boots and all, than those that opposed. So it is, we're coming out of this time. And I think there's lots of the fog of war, as you said, has been lifted from a lot of people now. And I think we need to get on down. We need to put our gummies on, roll our sleeves up, and do our own chickens and put our voices together and actually start saying, you know, no, we're not going to do that. Oh, Wellington, you're having trouble with your pipes. Well, you reap what you sow, Wellington. I'm sorry. Dunedin, you know.
Yeah, there's also the politics as vaccination theory that I've got, where there seemed to be a movement to use political leaders as vaccines in a way that the mRNA shots never were. You know, and you inject a weakened form of what you're trying to eliminate into the body politic. And, so you get these people like Christopher Hipkins that, if you think in any sort of survival situation, he's the last person you'd be picking as a leader. Justin Trudeau. You just think of all these funny little people. And, you know, there are no doubt a lot of people looking at Javier Milei, you know, in terms of just how he has gotten Argentina back to, what is it, a $16 billion trade surplus.
Yeah.
Did you see his video where he was going, Minister of Culture, gone. Gone. And, you know, the interesting thing about the bravery to do that, if you've got a leader that people will follow, I mean, Christopher Luxon's another example. Try and imagine a survival situation where Christopher Luxon's your leader. Maybe if you're in a boardroom having a Ricky Gervais office kind of thing going on, but he just doesn't have the ability to lead that kind of process, because he doesn't seem to be that good at presenting vision, because I don't think he's got much.
No.
But like the flag. It's like, okay, you know, there's so much that we could do. And in order to get people to cope with inevitable discomfort that comes from that sort of radical chopping of the public sector, you've got to have a path that they can exert effort that's going to make things better for their descendants. And in order to do that, you've got to have a commitment to a national identity, so people kind of hang together. And that's the big problem that we're seeing with multiculturalism as well, that all these nations have just lost this shared vision for what they're going to do. And it's a bit like the corporations are fracking society. They're kind of breaking it up in order to extract more resources for it, but it's not necessarily
good thing. It's funny you should say about leadership and bringing people together. Did you read, I think, what is it, The Weekend Herald, Monopoly Man, by Shane Jones, a Sebastian Castor in the provinces? So Joseph Losey, I have to admit, every now and then I think, oh, I quite like something, and then I look and he's on the byline. So he's doing some good work, Joseph. Anyhow, just you saying that in terms of bringing people together, Shane Jones, you know, he's bounced around the political spectrum. I mean, he was with Labour for a long time, then he's been with New Zealand First. I kind of feel like oh, Matua Shane is coming into himself now, you know, as a leader, as a politician. And he says here, politics was a popularity contest. That would be different. But as an MP, you're given a mandate from the people, Jones told the Herald. You can't govern New Zealand purely for Kandala or Koemarama, Jones said of the wealthy neighbourhoods in Wellington and Auckland. But unless we offer hope and innovative thinking to our Māori whānau, don't be surprised the mokopuna are continually attracted towards gangs. And he's referring to, he's got more money again, so we all know that he had the regional fund when he was with Jacinda. They now have this regional investment fund, $1.2 billion, and he's looking at mostly a series of loans as opposed to grants. So he's saying
co-funding arrangement,
yeah, as opposed from the provincial growth fund. And they are looking at things like rail lines into provincial areas, yeah, to get things moving.
Or handling systems, things like that.
Yeah, irrigation systems up to actually improve farming, like pretty practical stuff. And yeah, when you've got regions like Timaru, who, you know, all those Smithfield workers, Awakuni, losing those two plants across there, if the sort of money is spent in those sorts of regions to help get growth going with other businesses to create those jobs so those people do not get on a plane and go to Australia, has been highlighted by several articles across the weekend as well, and we can keep those people here. It's not just a brain drain that we're losing to Australia, but it's also a muscle drain, it's a people drain, it's a provincial drain that we're losing to Australia.
Yeah, and ultimately a capital drain as well, because those people might sell their houses and take that money to Australia.
He, for me, is one of the few people currently who is showing a sense of mana and leadership.
Yeah. And what he's doing is a very Māori way of thinking about it. He's sort of moving it away from the reductionist neoliberal idea where everything's got to stand on its own strengths, and saying basically the nation is a whole entity and it's got to be, there are flow-on effects, and sometimes you can't chop a frog down to cells and know what the frog is.
Mm. He's also fighting against, as you know, he's mining. He wants to get that up and running. And one of the things he's fighting against, for example, is Te Pāti Māori, especially, who do not want to have any mining, particularly on the seabed, happen. Now, Debbie Ngārewa Packer has gone on the record in an interview that not only do they want everything that's on the land, they want everything that's under the water as well. So the reason they're opposing it is because they want to have more than their fair share. Jones' response is unapologetic. The iron sands off the coast of Taranaki contain an extremely valuable mineral, vanadium, possibly first time in history in the Western world that the mineral has been listed in a political document, Jones said of the chemical element, which is the symbol V in the atomic number 23. If we're able to extract the mineral, we have the third largest deposit after Russia and China of a mineral essential to the decarbonisation journey. The very people who fret about burning the planet complain we can't mine vanadium. Our economic circumstances are so dire, we struggle to meet the costs of our military, our hospitals, our infrastructure, our schools. We can no longer indulge in green fantasies, and I hope to be minister who keeps leading the trade-off decisions. Good on you, Shane Jones. And you know the other thing about that? The third largest deposit outside of Russia and China.
Mm.
One of my greatest fears in terms of security, if anybody were to come down and test our security here in this country, we are literally up shit creek without a paddle.
Yeah.
We do not have the boots on the ground to protect ourselves. We just simply don't. If we have got these minerals here, I really do believe that our strategic value for particularly countries like China, is what's under our feet, has always been what's under our feet.
Mm.
And, you know, he's highlighted it right there. And but that's also our greatest asset. And yet, you know, so good on you.
Well, I mean, I think he is missing a trick by saying we can't keep indulging green fantasies. If you take that same line of thinking of the country as a whole, then you could say, okay, we're about to have some unemployment, but let's get some missions that would be like Eastern medicine, good for things on a whole series of ways, education, the environment, the economy, and we make something that is a public work, restoring rivers, growing animal feed on idle land. just things that overall boost our productivity. And you could have a plan that said, okay, we're going to do a bit more mining, but these rivers are going to be awesome. You're going to be able to look at a lot of New Zealand landscapes, and they're being planted in such a way that they're beautiful. That's going to help tourism. It's going to mean that a lot of kids are going to be able to learn about ecology on site. We're going to look at blah, blah, blah. Let's get a hemp industry growing. So we're making plastics out of that rather than depending on importing them from Asia.
Yeah, indeed.
I think he could follow that thinking down. And I think most New Zealanders have got common interests. We've just been allowed the nudge units to divide us and characterize the others as evil. It's high time to move beyond that.
Mm. Hey, I want to jump over to American politics for a little bit because, you know, we're starting to get to the pointy end of that campaign. And whilst, you know, you and I can't vote in it, I think the outcome of the American election is going to have dramatic ripples across the Western Hemisphere. It did crop up in a few of the columns. Both Ran O'Sullivan and Shane DePoe made mention. You've made mention before of the media's concentration on what it would mean to have Kamala Harris as president, and that would be better for New Zealand. Shane DePoe was interesting. I want to start there. Donald Trump, a symbol of disruption. I thought, oh, well, you know, I preloaded in my mind what I thought Shane might say. And then when I read it, it's like, oh, that's not what I was expecting. So Shane DePoe has spent a lot of time in the US. He's just about to head back across there. And he talks about, he really just opines about the fact that he misses the days where people would be busy and going about their lives, dip into a little bit of legacy media, and that legacy media told them everything that they needed to know, and they had suitable opinions about those things based on what they heard in legacy media. And of course, people don't trust it anymore, are actively avoiding it and getting the news from elsewhere.
I read his columns in Helen Clark's voice now. They make more sense then. They make perfect sense because people love the Helen Clark voice. Trump is a symbol of disruption and the continually shifting plates of political coalitions. However, he is not the cause. A primary cause of that disruption has been the flow of information from and to non-traditional sources. People who were once passive consumers of information, or the good old days, who may have watched the news, read a newspaper, or received information one way from their church or union, and are bombarded on their phones through multiple news sites and social media platforms day and night. The technocracy is losing control.
Yeah.
The globalism of the Helen Clark mindset of those technocrats is losing their grip. The fact he doesn't offer solutions appears to mean less than his well-aimed attacks. He offers plenty of solutions, Shane.
Hmm. Also, too, I think the fact that he hates the fact that Donald Trump has won, is winning the hearts and minds of everyday Americans,
the working
class. And he says a little, and I think that that's really what's getting in his craw. Political upheaval in the US isn't unexpected or odd. Think of New Zealand. It was not the traditional Labour working class voters that led to the Vietnam War or Springbok Tour opposition. It was the university educated liberal who infused the party from the 1960s.
That's like me.
That's kind of the quiet part out loud there, Shane. And it just shows you that that whole veneer of what the foundations of what they built themselves on has disappeared. They haven't been reading the room for a very long time. And Donald, you know, I mean, look, that imagery, it's very, very clever. I mean, the imagery in the last few days of Donald Trump going in and working a shift in his tie in at McDonald's. Look, I know it's all set up, but you have that contrasted against Kamala Harris, who has literally trotted out exactly the same speech with the same gesticulations, rally after rally after rally after rally. So you can't even tell where she is because it's all exactly the same. And then when somebody at a rally yells out, "Jesus is Lord," the one off-the-cuff moment that she has turned around and says, "Oh, I think you're at the wrong rally." It's like, wow, Kamala, you've just, you know, any of those liberal Christian votes that you may have had could have potentially left the room.
Well, yeah. Someone did a breakdown of her speech with just the time she said Donald Trump, and it was like 40 times or something.
Yeah. Yeah. The Brett Baier interview, she spent more time talking about Donald Trump than she did talking about her own policies. So it will really just come down to, I think, the US election is, they're already, oh God, the polls, and depending on which polls you look at as well, I mean, they're all over the show. And I think a lot of it will come down to A, who turns out, B, of those ones that traditionally don't turn out, will they turn out? And
C, can the mainstream media characterize allegations that Tim Walz had sex with a 14-year-old male student, at least one of them, and did a few other creepy things as a teacher, as Russian disinformation this time?
Well, I mean, will they be able to laptop that like they did last time? Can they play that trick more than once, Martin?
Well, they've let in 20 million, by some estimates, illegals. They're prosecuting the governor of Virginia, I think, federally for removing 4,000 non-citizens from the voting rolls, which is what he should be doing constitutionally. In California, it's illegal to ask people to present ID before they vote. One of the two most censored topics on social media is postal ballots, and that includes if someone posts a video showing a Democratic Party operative stuffing ballots. The talk in Republican circles is, making this an election for Trump, turnout for Trump that's too big to rig, is what they're saying. They're behind where they were in 2016, especially in swing states. There was that article Fran O'Sullivan wrote about Trump. What's at stake as Trump eyes a comeback? It was like she wrote it in her sleep, because it's kind of a poorly blended mix of Washington Post talking points and then sort of fizzles out into whether or not the Secret Service is up to stopping him being shot. But she was quoting the breathless frettings of retired US Army General Mike Milley and how much he's suffered for his involvement in the January 6th riots. And a lot of those people do have a lot to fear, because a lot of the current crop of US generals are pretty useless.
Yeah, and very woke too.
Yeah, he's put them on watch. I mean, you got that, I can't remember the name of that person who dresses up as a lady.
Levine?
About racism.
Admiral in name only.
Yeah, meanwhile, China's doing war games. All of these developments, which mean that there's likely to be conflict and you don't necessarily want men dressing up as women as your primary interest.
Well, we're going to have to watch the space as things gets closer, and I think it's just only going to get more intense over time, but it will be very, very interesting to see what does actually shake out in the United States. And then, of course, the Canadians go to the polls the following year as well. That's another one to watch. Now, have you got anything else on your list that's pressing before we move to feedback? Because we do have a bit of that this week.
There was a picture of, I thought it was a bit dangerous. They had did you read that article, Psychedelic Nation, Study Trip into Our Class A Drug Culture?
Funnily enough, I did. And normally I would have skipped over an article like that, but after interviewing Norman Ola, which I did a couple of months back, and I was like, oh, actually, I'm going to read that. That was rather fascinating.
Yeah, it was a bit irresponsible of them having a fly agaric, one of those spotty orange with white spots mushrooms as a magic mushroom. I hope that doesn't result in anyone eating one. You have to prep them pretty carefully to get any hallucinogenic effect off them, because the main active ingredient is ibotenic acid rather than psilocybin.
Not that I would know anything about that, of course, but what I liked about talking to Norman Ola, and that sort of study kind of touched on it a little bit, was what I hadn't considered until I'd spoken to Norman was the mischaracterization of some groups of drugs in order to actually get a sense of control. And in the case of these hallucinogens, the whole reason they're classed where they're classed is because the CIA wanted to have complete control over them for their own nefarious purposes way back in the 1960s. I mean, it's as simple as that.
They're horrific experiments.
Yeah.
Horrific, unethical experiments.
Yeah. So it's essentially state control and bad policy that's filtered down since then that is there. And actually any positive effect that these substances and compounds could have for treating things like chronic addiction, chronic depression, PTSD, dementia, have all been sidelined because it's been criminalized by the powers that
be. No, I listened to that interview. Was he wanting to call it LSD for grandma or something like that?
Yeah, LSD for mum, mama. Right. LSD for mama, yeah.
Acid for mama or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of things we've missed out on by characterising. You know, I'm told by people who've taken acid that, you know, one of the things that they often find if they do it in a suitable setting is they think, why is this illegal? You know, it's not really necessarily always a drug experience. It's not a recreational thing. It's not an easy matter all the time. And it's, as Terence McKenna said, you know, not going through life without having a psychedelic experience is a bit like going through life without having sex.
Mm. Oh, there you go. There you go. Now, we got quite a bit of feedback this week, which kind of makes sense because, of course, I had my little bit of a chat about what's been going on. We have, Phil has done an interview with Alistair, so that has now been done. And the other thing that's happened since I spoke to everybody last week is we do now have a sentence, which came through late on Thursday, and it did not go our way. Generally, the way these things work is that you, as a defendant, your lawyer argues what they believe we would like, you know, is fair for the sentence. The prosecution puts in what they believe is warranted for the sentence. And of course, they will put in the worst that they possibly can because that's the prosecution. And generally, the judge comes down somewhere in the middle. That's usually how these things work. In our particular case, it came down.
Not so much, no.
It came down exactly what the prosecution asked for, which none of us were expecting. So all I can say on that is watch this space. So I can't say much more than that. We just sort of have got a few decisions to make. So yes, not exactly what we were after, but what we did get was a tremendous amount of support from people out there after I had my chat. So the first up, your husband is a hero. Marie, I'm so sorry he got caught. He should never have been put in that situation. There are many of us that put our heads down and just carried on. Though, like your husband, a handful are now facing HPD, Health Practitioner Disciplinary Tribunals. History will favour us, Kia Kaha. And that was from an anonymous first-time texter. So thank you.
Yeah. As I've said, there's that criticism that the doctors who stood up are such a tiny proportion of the majority. There's quite a leverage effect. Not everyone's got the stones to stand on their convictions, particularly when if they get their income interrupted, it stops the whole show.
Oh, absolutely. And also
they lose the house, they lose, you know, the kids can't go to private school, the wife probably buggers off.
Yeah. And you know what? We know that. I mean, we lost our business through this. Yeah. So, you know, we understood the risks. And one of the things before we did what we did is I did say to Mr. Marie is that we needed to protect the family home. So that was my one stake in the ground. And we put measures in place to be able to protect the family home. And I said, look, I will go to the mattresses with you on this as long as the roof over our head is safe and the roof over our children's head is safe. So that's what we did, and that's what we were able to maintain and protect. So I totally get it. I totally get it. This one is from, I'm a nurse and midwife, was a clinical midwife specialist and was mandated. I was shocked by not only the lack of professional ethical behaviour of some nurses and midwives, but also the sheer nastiness expressed against their colleagues and the general public who declined to be vaccinated. See, that's that cult behaviour again, isn't it? The director of nursing of the DHB I worked for sent letters to the nursing council recommending each individual nurse who declined vaccination and was mandated was unfit for practice. But on Facebook, nurses were posting that they would not treat the unvaccinated or would be left in the corridors and be the last to treat it. This unethical behaviour was ignored by the nursing council.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, when the masks went on, the masks came off. There was that horrifying stat where 30% of Democrat voters in the states thought that people who refused to get vaccinated should have their children taken off them.
Yeah.
You know, those people who we've read about, well, those types of people who we've read about in history and tut-tutted, and they're still there. And we've got to acknowledge that they are.
But if someone exercised their right of free speech to discuss the ethics of coercion to have the medical procedure they deemed unethical, in my training, informed choice and consent were foundational to healthcare ethics, and the Cartwright Report, Patients' Rights, and the Health and Disability Commissioner featured heavily. But that all turned out to be mere words. I cannot describe my disappointment. I worked in a berry farm, weeded on my hands and knees for 7.5 hours a day, and packed the shelves at Kmart. My friend who was a vaccinator told me people who came to be vaccinated because they needed to keep their jobs would cry and were very angry. I did ask her how she was behaving ethically, knowing that these people were there because they were coerced, not because they were exercising free choice and informed consent. If we actually upheld our professional ethics, this would have never have happened, Margaret.
Hear, hear, Margaret.
Yeah, hear, hear, Margaret. Thank you so much. And we can't forget, this is the problem. You know, whilst we're in this undies stage, we can't forget those people that were running around in their undies telling everybody that they were wearing togs. We can't forget that. It's really important that we don't. Right. I haven't written to you for a while. So if no one has told you lately, you guys are the bestest. That's for you and I, Marty. Thanks for your level-headed critical thinking and analysis. Take care, Beth. Thank you.
Thanks, Beth. We appreciate it.
Hi, Marie. Loving today's chat. Sitting around in the clandestine rooms with like-minded people is fun, but we will not win the war if we don't get out there now and wake people up. We have the numbers. Let's use our mass to get the job done. If we can wake one or two a day, we will get there in no time. And that's from Gordon from Foxton. Oh, I think Gordon might be a little contemporary of Mike from Foxton. I hear there's quite a coterie of them down there.
Right.
Thanks,
well,
Gordon.
You know, I've started doing is sharing RCR programs with people who are arguing points with little information on Twitter particularly. And I just really ask that people share. That's our big challenge at the moment at RCR, is to get more people exposed to some of the great interviews that are there, and some of the great campaigns as well. The stuff around CBDCs, you know, is a really good fresh way to come into it if people are COVID fatigued.
Yeah, and all the new fluoride stuff too.
The fluoride stuff, yeah.
And this is another one, actually. Exactly.
Alistair Harding is doing some great work there. Good stuff, Alistair.
Yeah, and directly talking to your point, listening to Marty and Marie suggesting sending links, my strategy is saving key RCR content onto USB sticks and dropping them into visiting family members' bags. That's a great idea. Oh, I love it. A massive congratulations for your strength and humility, Marie, and the stand that you and your husband have taken. You make me proud to be Kiwi. My hearts are with you both. Janet, Mochiweka. Thank you, Janet. We appreciate it.
Mochiweka, Janet.
Yeah, so thanks for sharing this, Marie. So it's great. And then from Diane, can't wait, Marie and Phil have been amazing for the strength that they've had and shown steadfast belief in their ethics and their fundamental rights and the oath that Phil swore to uphold. They are my heroes, so proud of you both. And thanks, Diane. And Diane was with us at a number of the hearings here locally, and a tremendous. We've just had such wonderful support from the people around us. It's been great. From Lindley, gosh, what a drawn-out, terrible time you've had to endure. You've suffered a completely ridiculous set of circumstances, and it's resulted in the loss of 30 years of medical knowledge and from the regional community, and people wonder why our health system is in crisis. Or finally, I was thinking after this week's Media Matters with Marty and Marie, Mr. Marie's case may now be studied by law students who have to do a compulsory tikanga course. It could be. It was groundbreaking, and what other example cases do they have to study? It would mean sharing the COVID scam even further into those young woke minds. Wouldn't that be fabulous? From Diane. There was one here I'm going to share with you because it's on the Fourth Estate, and you probably don't share your own feedback on the Fourth Estate. So I'm going to do it for you. And this is from Chris. It's good to put a face to the name. I really enjoy your talks with Marie. Also, brilliant, Marty. There you go.
Thanks.
Yes, it's been a bit of a ride, and we'll have to, just keep an eye out to what transpires. Long weekend, though. Hope you and the Van Dam, we are, as Marty said before, share. We are taking a RCR long weekend. Perfect time to catch up on some of your listening. And if you hear something you think, oh, I know someone that will really appreciate that, please do share it.
Yeah, we're kind of getting up to 2 years now, aren't we?
Coming close, March.
We've been at it. And we've managed to do that without without too many missteps. And that really is tribute to, I guess, the unity of the people involved and the ethics of them. If you meet them, they're all nice folks, and they've got a real heart for the people of the country and people of the world. And you know, it's something that I think, as I said, once more people are actually exposed to it and listen to it, they'll see that it's not maybe what they thought it was.
Well, and unlike other legacy media outlets, this is not about the personalities, it's about the mission. And it's always
it's not about the advertisers, it's about the listeners.
Exactly. So thank you very much for everyone that's listened. 2057 is the text number. If you want to drop us a text, or inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email. And you and I, of course, will do it all again next week, and we'll be back to Thursdays next week. So you only got us a little special Wednesdays from this week, but back to Thursdays next week. So you have a great weekend, Marty.
Awesome. Will do. And same to you. Have a great week, everyone.
All right, we'll catch everybody again next week, again back to Thursdays. Take care until then. Bye.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.